Hello, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm David Rogowski, and today I will be reading from Outside Magazine. And next up, we have Inside the Battle to Ride Mountain Bikes on Mount Tamalpais. After years of work, cycling advocates got the go-ahead to ride trails on the iconic California mountain, but a court order stopped the plan dead in its track. This is by Maureen Gaffney. From the top of California's 2,579-foot Mount Tamalpais, one can gaze out on a commanding view of San Francisco, the Pacific Ocean, and the Golden Gate Bridge. But it wasn't the overlook that lured 200 mountain bikers to the mountain on the crisp morning of Saturday, November 2nd. The cyclists had ridden to the summit on paved and dirt roads in an organized protest. They wanted to show local authorities that mountain bikers deserved a ride on the local trail system, the same dirt pass where mountain biking was born nearly 50 years ago. I'm free to Mount Tam. I'm here to free Mount Tam, Andy Scott, 59-year-old cyclist from nearby San Anselmo, told Outside. It was once inhabited by all users and now only by a limited few. Mountain biking has been prohibited on the trail since the mid-80s, but recent efforts to open the trails back up to cyclists have been gathering steam. The protest, which was labeled Liberate Mount Tam by its organizers, came on the heels of a controversial lawsuit and subsequent court order that stymied their access to the trails. In April, the Marin Municipal Water District, the government agency that manages much of the public land on the mountain, approved two pilot programs to allow cyclists access to 6.6 miles of trails on the peak. The approval came after 6 years of planning, community outreach, studies, and lobbying by local cycling advocacy groups. The trails are set to open to mountain bikers Friday, October 4th. But the afternoon before the opening, a judge issued a temporary restraining order that halted progress. Three local environmental groups, Marin Conservation League, California Native Plant Society, and Marin Audubon, filed a lawsuit to block the plan. They argued that the Water District failed to comply with the California Environmental Quality Act, which requires public land managers to investigate and then publish the impact of a wide range of projects, from trail building to forest thinning. The lawsuit did not sit well with mountain bikers or the cycling advocacy groups. The Marin County Bicycle Coalition has gone out of its way to collaborate with Marin Conservation League and others over the years in an earnest desire to hear and understand their concerns, said Krista Hoff, the off-road director of the local advocacy group, Marin County Bicycle Coalition, MCBC. They are not interested in equitable access. But officials from environmental groups disagree, say they are simply doing what's right to protect Mount Tam's ecology from damage. The Marin Conservation League's interest is in moderating growth and intensity of recreation so it does not cause further impact, says Nona Dennis, president of the Marin Conservation League. All recreation has an impact on the environment. The development is just the latest skirmish in a decades-long war that cyclists have waged legally to legally ride the trails in mountain biking's birthplace. How mountain bikes were chased off Mount Tam. In the 70s, a ragtag group of local cyclists, including Gary Fisher, Joe Breeze, Wendy Craig, Charlie Kelly, and Otis Guy, modified beach cruisers and rode them down the trails and fire roads on Mount Tam. The group called their innovative bikes clunkers, and their adventurous rides helped launch modern mountain biking. But many Marin County locals didn't like cyclists riding the trails. Citing environmental and safety concerns, well-organized groups attended town meetings and wrote to the elected officials asking to ban the new form of recreation. By 1984, local authorities officially shut down Mount Tam's trails to cyclists. We really couldn't understand the hostility from the land managers, Otis Guy, who is now 71 years old and was at the recent November protest, told Outside, "We care about these lands. We should be considered an asset, not a threat." Similar rules spread across California and the country in the 80s and 90s. Disputes over trail usage often pitted mountain bikers against hikers and equestrians, with the latter user groups regularly gaining the upper hand. In Marin and nearby Alameda County, rules restricted bicycles to dirt maintenance roads, which are 12 to 15 foot wide and usually steep. The single-track trails, meanwhile, were off-limits. Loss of trail access prompted five California mountain bike clubs to formally create a lobbying group in 1988 called the International Mountain Biking Association, or IMBA. It advocated for cyclists' access to trails and showed local mountain biking communities how to build and manage trail systems. Local cycling advocacy groups like Access for Bikes and MCBC also pressured Marin officials to allow cyclists on the trails. These groups helped mountain bikers gain access to other trail systems in Marin County in the early 2000s, but the dirt trails on Mount Tam remained off-limits. "We're still fighting the same stupid battles," Guy said. IMBA showed the world years ago how to build trails, and it's all been done with no negative impact across the country, but Marin County is a different place. This is a process that took years to complete. The pilot program to allow mountain bikers mountain bikes on Mount Tam took 6 years to come together. Biking advocacy groups also worked to nominate cycling-friendly managers onto the Marin Water District's board of directors. Since 2020, Bill Keene, a board member for the cycling advocacy group Access for Bikes, has knocked on approximately 2,000 doors in Marin County to stump for bike-friendly candidates for the water board. Both Access for Bikes and Marin County Bicycle Coalition persuaded their members to attend local hearings, board meetings, and community hikes, and to write letters on behalf of cyclists. The advocacy work paid off. In April, the board voted unanimously to approve the two pilot programs for the 6.6 miles of trail, one for regular mountain bikes and another for e-mountain bikes. Officials from the bike advocacy group told Outside that the local environmental groups were part of the planning process and had years to raise concerns. They were at the meetings, they had a seat at the table, Guy says. This is how cooperative people and processes work. But representatives from environmental groups told Outside that the Marin Water District failed to provide detailed reports on how mountain biking would impact the flora and fauna of Mount Tam during this process. Dennis told Outside that Marin Water District also failed to disclose which trails or roads would be open to cyclists until 2024. The first 2 to 3 years were mostly talk with no reference to any specific roads or trails on the watershed, nor even tentative improvements proposed, Dennis said. The lawsuit claims that the water district's land contains critical biological resources, including dozens of rare plant species and plant communities, and that the addition of mountain bikes and e-bikes to these trails and roads has the potential to harm these resources. Dennis said that the Marin Water District failed to acknowledge that some e-bikes motors emit a high-frequency noise that can disrupt bat colonies, and the plan didn't explain how the increased use would impact the northern spotted owl, a threatened species. A CEQA review would have included such analysis and, furthermore, would allow for public comment, she said. The Marin Water District declined a request for an interview, but in a press release, a spokesperson for the Water District said it took the requisite steps asked for prior to approving the mountain biking pilot program. The district worked hard to assess watershed trail conditions, monitor trail use data, and engage with a range of user groups in order to design trial programs that allow for expanded recreational interests without compromising our number one priority, protection of our community's drinking water and the biological diversity that exists within this incredible natural resource, the release said. Keene, who oversees advocacy for Access for Bikes, said the lawsuit caught the cyclist groups by surprise. Marin Conservation League indicated they would not sue, he said. Pilot trails were selected to avoid environmentally sensitive areas, and the litigants know this. But Dennis said her group made no such promise. Instead, she says her group sent a letter to the Marin Water District prior to a hearing in early September, warning of a potential legal challenge. When the Water District approved the pilot program, Dennis said her group felt like it had no other option. The MCL board determined we only had one resource, that is, to join the other two nonprofits as a co-plaintant, she said. In our view, the district's failure to conduct adequate CEQA review before opening the trails to bikes was an abuse of CEQA. Pilot programs are stalled, but not dead. Outside attended the November 2nd rally on Mount Tam, spoke to more than a dozen cyclists in attendance. At the November 2 rally, many of the cyclists expressed their dismay. There are dams on Mount Tam. There are miles upon miles of roads. There was a train to the top, said Vernon Huffman, president of Access for Bikes. You can't tell me that this place is free of human impact and that the bikes are an environmental harm. But for the time being, the status quo remains on Mount Tam. No e-bikes are allowed anywhere in the watershed, even on fire roads, and bicycles are forbidden on the single-track trails. The pilot programs are on hold indefinitely. In December, a Marin County judge strengthened the environmental group's position by issuing preliminary injunctions on both the e-bike and single-track pilot programs. The injunction doesn't entirely kill the program, but it will prevent from happening in early 2025. Whether or not this setback deters the mountain bikers on Mount Tam is yet to be seen. Hoff wrote a letter to the Marin Independent Journal saying she was hopeful that the case will be decided in favor of more equitable recreational opportunities for people who ride. Atop Mount Tam on November 2nd, Keene and Huffman stood in the bed of a pickup truck and addressed the cyclists from a bullhorn. This is the way to take back Tam, they yelled. The crowd responded with a chant that pinged across the parking lot, Liberate Tam, Liberate Tam. And next up we have, This is How to Survive Hypothermia. Getting too cold can kill you. Here's what you can do to prevent that from happening and how to rescue yourself if it does. It's by Wes Seiler. 3 years ago, I was pursuing a herd of elk down a steep gully into a remote mountain valley in southwest Montana when it began to snow. The storm was unexpected and hyperlocal. It often is in the mountains. It was only the middle of September, so I wore thin base layers under soft shell pants, a thin fleece jacket, and low-top hiking boots. I opted to leave my rain gear and insulation in my truck 6 miles away to travel as fast and light as possible. As the snow turned heavier and wetter, it soaked through my layers and into my boots, leaving me totally drenched. I really began to worry when I stopped shivering. Hypothermia is caused around 1,500 deaths a year in the United States, according to a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Hypothermia begins to occur when the body's core temperature falls below 95 degrees, according to Chris Adams, a flight nurse for the Life Flight Network, a nonprofit transport network that takes high-risk patients to hospitals by helicopter. Working out of Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, Adams says he treats hypothermia virtually every time he rescues a trauma victim. The majority of hypothermia cases happen in rural environments where emergency services may be unavailable or slow to respond. And in many colder places, hypothermia is the second most common cause of unintentional death after vehicle accidents. Hypothermia is particularly dangerous because the occurrence often involves unexpected, just like during my elk hunt. My ATV was waiting on a trail 1,000 feet above me, at least a 30-minute hike away. My efforts to reach the vehicle partially dried my torso and legs, but my hands and feet were still totally numb by the time I climbed the gully. Riding the ATV back to my truck was a challenge. The numbness in my fingers made it hard to operate the controls, and the urgency to reach safety had to be balanced with additional wind chill created by speed. By the time I got to my truck and clumsily climbed into the driver's seat, a glance in the rearview mirror revealed blue lips surrounded by a ghastly pale face. I cranked the heat, turned on my seat warmer, and sat in silence for half an hour while the shivers returned and stabbing pain crept into my extremities. According to Adams, I was probably in a stage of mild severity while hiking up the mountain, then into moderate hypothermia by the time I'd reached the truck. Preparing to survive, hypothermia is an essential skill for those of us who recreate outdoors in cold weather. How can you tell if you have hypothermia? Luckily, hypothermia has clear indications. Watch for the umbles, stumbles, mumbles, fumbles, and grumbles, which show change in motor coordination and levels of consciousness, reads a white paper on hypothermia published by Princeton University. Medical professionals parse the stage of hypothermia by internal body temperature. But since you can't get an accurate read of your body's internal temperature with oral thermometers, according to a University of Minnesota paper, you and I are better off looking at symptoms. According to Adams, symptoms of hypothermia include feeling cold, loss of motor control, including both fine, operating zippers, and gross, the ability to walk. Impaired mental abilities impacting speech and consciousness, the slowing of respiratory and heart rates. A mild hypothermic person will still be shivering, but begin to lose fine motor control. A telltale sign of moderate hypothermia is when the victim stops shivering and when walking and standing become difficult. In a severe stage of hypothermia, a person may be unable to stand or walk and will likely lose consciousness altogether. Beyond that, the body approaches death as its heart rate slows to just a few beats per minute. Breathing stops and eventually the heart fails. Uncontrolled shivering, slurred speech, confusion, and reduced coordination can quickly spiral into unconsciousness, John Barklow tells Outside. After serving as a Navy diver, Barklow trained Navy SEALs in cold weather survival techniques, including self-treatment of mild to moderate hypothermia. Designed clothing systems intended to reduce the odds of special operations forces experiencing hypothermia, and now works as the lead designer for Bozeman, Montana-based technical clothing brand Sitka Gear, while still teaching survival classes and seminars. So how to prevent hypothermia? Beyond wearing enough insulation to remain warm in a given temperature, it's important to consider the materials you're wearing. The worst of those is cotton, because cotton fibers are hollow and carry a negative electrical charge. They absorb and retain positively charged water. Cotton fabrics can hold up to 27 times their own weight in water, then refuse to dry out. Wool is a lot better. It absorbs only 30% of its weight in water, and the microscopic structure of its fibers can work to break the bonds between hydrogen and oxygen atoms, producing a tiny amount of heat. Down, even varieties treated with hydrophobic coatings designed to repel water loses its ability to loft and keep you warm when wet. Best are synthetic fabrics and insulation like polyester and nylon, which only absorb around 0.4 to 4% of their weight in water, respectively. Because synthetic materials dry so much faster as a result, they're a much safer option in cold, wet conditions or when you run risk of submersion. I've recently transitioned to all synthetic clothing systems for backcountry adventures for that reason. In what Barklow calls a rewarming drill, he submerges participants in freezing cold water, then instructs those students to add layers of synthetic insulation, drink water, and consume easily digested calories. Patients huddle inside breathable rain shells designed to keep out the weather and prevent convective heat loss. The warmth generated by their bodies, held in by the warm when wet synthetic insulation, is able to force water first away from their skin. Moisture gets drawn out through the layers of clothing, enabling their bodies to return to safe temperatures. With a great clothing system, there's no need to carry extra equipment, Barklow says. Adams backs this up. That's a really good idea. If you have the right clothes, he states, preparation is everything. The nurse also says that if you begin to experience hypothermia symptoms and you're alone in the backcountry, you should focus on creating body heat. You can hike up a hill really fast, he says. So how to treat hypothermia? Barklow's method also tracks with survival advice given by Wilderness Medical Society, which prescribes protecting yourself or a patient from the environment, drying them out, and then warming them up using a heat source. With Barklow's method, which requires synthetic clothing layers, you don't need to remove any clothing and you don't need a fire. Should you lack such a clothing system, the approach becomes a little more complicated. You'll need shelter, dry insulation, and a heat source. In mild stages of hypothermia, you can use something as simple as a tent or a dry sleeping bag, another person's body heat, warm water bottle, or chemical heat packs. Place the latter two items on the neck, armpits, and groin where large arteries pass close to the skin. As you progress into moderate and severe cases, hypothermia will require more significant sources of heat, like a heated structure or vehicle or a wood stove, and ultimately treatment by medical professionals. Adams recommends paying close attention to preventing convective heat loss through contact with the cold ground and suggests chemical heat blankets, like those sold by ReadyHeat, as a heat source. I lay down a wool blanket, put a heated blanket on top of that, lay the patient down, then layer heated blankets and another wool blanket on top of that, describes Adams. Then we just crank the heat in the helicopter until the patient warms back up. Adams is careful to caution against shocking a hypothermia victim with too much heat, though saying you shouldn't submerge them in a hot bath or shower. It's got to be slow, he says. Just focus on getting the ambient temperature nice and high and rewarming slowly. What about CPR? In severe stages of hypothermia, a person's pulse may not be detectable at the wrist due to severely constricted blood vessels, and when checked at the carotid artery, may be as slow as just a few beats per minute. Adams warns against chest compressions as a result, but says blowing warm air into unconscious victims' lungs may help increase their core temperature. Barklow recommends that you don't just leave survival skills up to chance. You need to train in realistic conditions to ensure you and your gear perform as expected, he says. Ensuring your layers are a match for the conditions is something you should first try in a safe environment. You don't want to realize that you and your kit aren't up to the task of saving your life after you swim a glacier-fed rapid while on a remote pack raft trip in Alaska, he says. Adams offers one final piece of advice: don't give up. Due to the protective effects of cold temperatures, complete recovery can be possible even in severe prolonged hypothermia cases. Wes Seiler returned from a trip to Yellowknife in northern Canada where temperatures were as low as minus 38 degrees Fahrenheit. He was warm, comfortable, and safe throughout. You can ask him more detailed questions about outdoor gear and other topics on Substack. And next up, we have, I had a heart attack while running. This is what it felt like. What endurance athletes can learn from one runner's close call. This is by Dennis Lewin. My favorite route to the top of Mount Sanitas in Boulder, Colorado, gains some 1,200 feet in just over a mile. Starts on the aptly named Goat Trail and then climbs the East Ridge Trail to the 6,800 foot summit. There are much better trails for running in Boulder, less rocky, less steep, but I prefer this route up Sanitas because it has a great view. It's near my home, and if nothing else, it's very efficient. I'm not a particularly good runner, definitely not fast, but I am consistent. Over the last 15 years, I've chugged up Sanitas more than 2,000 times. Occasionally, I'll mix it up with one of those other boulder trails where the grade is more running friendly and my dog can chase new smells, but we always come back to Sanitas, which is to say, I know the route to the top pretty well. I know where wildflowers appear in yellow and purple bunches in late spring and where ice persists in long after winter storms. I know where to water pools after summer rain and which pine tree smells like butterscotch. And I certainly know my pace. The ascent takes me about 30 minutes, depending on how many times I have to pick up my dog's poop. I once made it to the top in 22 minutes without the dog, which isn't bad for a middle-aged desk jockey. But for context, Kilian Jornet ran the nearly identical Mount Sanitas Trail in 14 minutes and 12 seconds, according to the fastest known time. Even at my slowest, though, I'm at least maintaining a steady jog. So I knew something was different when I suddenly stopped running halfway up. Weird, I thought, as I slowed to a walk with no conscious decision to downshift. It was a bright April day, perfect condition. I was glad to be back on Sanitas after a couple of weeks out of town. I'd been putt-putting along like normal on a section of trail that steepens considerably after a couple long switchbacks, and then suddenly I was walking. Felt like running underwater. I was telling my legs to run, but they just wouldn't go any faster. I felt fine in every other way, no pain, nothing. I was breathing hard, but that's a normal on a trail that ascends more than 1,000 feet per mile. This must be what serious athletes mean by hitting the wall, I thought. But why was I bonking on a trail I know so well? I continued to swim, walk, considering possibilities. Did I need to acclimatize to the altitude after being at sea level for 2 weeks? Did I have a virus that was sapping up my energy? Were the effects of aging unfolding the same way Ernest Hemingway in The Sun Also Rises described the process of going bankrupt? Gradually, then suddenly? More than a decade ago, surprising research sparked sensational headlines suggesting that endurance training might be bad, not good for your heart. Articles like One Running Shoe in the Grave captured the spirit of the moment. The counterintuitive results of these studies turned out to be flawed, but they did jumpstart a series of investigations into the relationship between endurance training and cardio health. Alex Hutchinson, Outside Sweat Science columnist, has written extensively about the subject. More recently, he dug into the latest news in two promising updates on heart health in endurance athletes. The upshot? It's clear that endurance training affects the heart, but it's difficult to say exactly what the change means. For example, one study found that master endurance athletes had elevated coronary artery calcium, CAC scores, compared to non-athletes, which on the surface is not good. Higher levels of arterial calcium are associated with a higher risk of serious and potentially fatal heart problems in the general population. That's because calcium deposits are a sign of possible plaque buildup on the artery walls, and when plaque breaks off, it can create a blockage, reducing or stopping the flow of blood. But the new research goes deeper, examining the differences in plaque between endurance athletes and non-athletes. It turns out that while CAC scores do increase in athletes over time, the athlete's plaque tends to be smooth and hard and unlikely to rupture compared to the softer plaque found in non-athletes. Crucially, one study found that the subjects with higher CAC scores caused by exercise did not have higher risk of cardiac events. Endurance training can affect the heart in other ways. It's a muscle, after all, and it responds to a workout. Researchers have documented microscarring in athletes' hearts, for example, but the studies are so far inconclusive when it comes to proving if specific changes are good or bad or neutral on the one thing it's safe to say we all care about, longevity. Fortunately, a 2022 study published in the journal Circulation speaks directly to that issue. It followed 116,221 adults over the course of 30 years. Researchers asked subjects to report on their exercise habits every 2 years, which provided a much more complete picture of the athleticism over time than previous studies. The takeaway? As Hutchinson sums it up in his reporting, the headline result is that those doing 150 to 300 minutes a week of vigorous exercise, such as running, or somewhat equivalently 300 to 600 minutes a week of moderate exercise, such as walking, were about half as likely to die during the study. That's good news for runners who have been confused by the mixed messages on heart health. 5 hours of running a week, about exactly how much time I spend going up and down Sanitas, is as good for your body as it is for your soul. Logging more than 300 minutes of vigorous exercise per week yielded about the same benefits. Of course, large epidemiological studies can't say anything about an individual's experience, which is why endurance athletes should take comfort in the latest research but pay very, very close attention to what their own bodies are telling them. Halfway up Sanitas, I should have stopped and paid a little more attention to my sudden inability to run. But mostly I felt confused, not worried, and embarrassed. I encountered my acquaintance who was going down the trail, and as she passed, my main goal was to jog a few steps or she didn't see me walking. I barely managed it. Then I started thinking about how late I would be getting to the top, where I was meeting a friend. Would he get impatient and leave? I kept slogging away, and though my legs felt the same, dead weights, I actually started to feel better about the situation. Just a fluke, I figured. I probably just need a good night's sleep. By the time I reached the rocky summit, I felt victorious, like I'd really achieved something. My friend Aaron didn't see it that way. You look like shit, he said when I arrived on top. Just need to catch my breath, I gasped, like I just finished a marathon, and I sank gratefully on a boulder. It took a few minutes longer than expected, but I did catch my breath and also fended off Aaron's efforts to ask if there were any doctors among the summit crowd. I felt vindicated and mostly back to normal on the descent. 2 hours later, after eating and drinking and showering, I was ready to write off the whole episode and try Sanitas again the next day, but two things changed my mind. My resting heart rate was still high, over 80, when it normally hovers in the 50s. When I called my wife, she encouraged me to get checked. If continuing up Sanitas that day was my first mistake, identifying my second is pretty easy. Riding a bike to the urgent care a half mile away. But at this point, I was feeling fine. Going to the doctor? Just an abundance of caution. So when the folks at urgent care said they lacked the required diagnostic tools and I needed to go to the emergency room at a hospital across town, I was mostly annoyed. I had to ride home and drive there. Mistake number 3. Driving. Things only coalesced for me when I was in the ER hooked up to an EKG machine and heard an announcement over the intercom. Cardiac alert, room 9. Room 9? That was my room. An hour later, I was in the operating room getting a stent inserted in my left anterior descending artery. According to the cardiologist, the artery had been partially blocked by an event I experienced while running. A piece of plaque, he said, had exploded and formed a clot. He couldn't say what had caused it, but he reassured me that the rest of my arteries were fine, and now this one was too. In my particular case, it's impossible to say if running had any role in the heart attack, either as a contributing or mitigating factor. Could exercise have led to an increase in plaque, or could some level of cardio fitness have protected my heart from damage while the blood flow was diminished? And did I have soft plaque despite running, or did I have hard plaque that ruptured anyway? Was it due to my genetics? My dad, 82, has 3 stents. Regardless, the cardiologist saw no reason for me to change my running habits. Just take it easy for a month, he said, and then I could resume exercising with no limitations. And that's exactly what I did, first on Sanitas and then farther afield. In the following months, I rafted the Grand Canyon, trekked in Nepal, and topped 17,000 feet. Drove a moped across northern Vietnam, a stress test if there ever was one. That sounds like a post-heart attack bucket list agenda. It's just a coincidence. The trips were already planned. So this is not the part where I reflect on my close call and embrace a newfound fervor to live for today. I like to think that we all have the capacity to appreciate how precious and fleeting life is without having a near-death experience. But there's something I've been thinking about on recent runs up Sanitas. Could endurance athletes, even very average ones like me, be their own worst enemies when it comes to recognizing serious medical events? After all, the ability to push through discomfort is literally the definition of endurance. We practice training our minds to overrule our bodies. That doesn't mean we should start walking instead of running. Heck, plenty of sedentary guys have ignored heart attack warning signs. There's no reason to miss out on the well-documented physical and mental benefits of endurance sports. So rather than backing off, and to be clear, this is my evidence-free opinion, I think we need to push a little harder. Most everyday athletes, even very accomplished ones, don't redline their bodies. Elite athletes may know what hitting the wall actually feels like, but most of us ease up well short of collapse. What if that's a mistake? What if knowing the full range of your potential, what it feels like at the outer edges of what you're capable of, is exactly what you need? Will you be more likely to notice and act when you enter unfamiliar territory? Before your experience in a heart attack, I thought I knew the symptoms, chest pain chief among them. But of course, it's not so clear cut. On tinnitus, shortness of breath and fatigue were my only complaints, and they were exactly what I expected to experience to varying degrees when running up a very, very steep hill. So go ahead, run hard, or bike hard, or hike hard, but take it from me. If you experience serious changes, take them seriously. Lewin says he isn't sure if he has good luck or bad, but this is actually his second close call in the backcountry. To hear about his first, listen to an episode of the Out Alive podcast. You have been listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I've been reading from Outside Magazine. My name is Dave Rogowski. Thank you for listening.